looking around to see what else is out there, but I've been using this repeater as a condition propagation beacon, you know, for the last couple of years, because even under flat conditions I can hear it, although sometimes I can't get in, but I can always hear it. So tonight it's just blasting.
Now, if somebody wants to look at what's going on here, if they go to QRZ.com and type in Whiskey Alpha 1 Victor Victor Hotel, I believe you've got a few of your pictures from your tower on that QRZ.com. Is that true, Harry?
Yeah, the ones that you saw are still up there, yes.
Okay, so if you guys are curious, want to see some curious ham radio hardware, go to W1VVH.com, VVH at QRZ.com, and you'll see some beautiful pictures. Well done, Harry. Okay, I think we've answered all the emails so far, so to speak. Anybody with any last questions for Paul before we lose the space net report tonight, give me a call at us right now. You got it, Jay.
Paul, do you know how many Marines they have now, and are they finding a body that is gravitationally attracted to another body and orbiting around?
I'm guessing that the astronomers have done some terrible things.
We'll see what happens there. As far as the description of the moons, I don't know. To me, Pluto will always be a planet, Jay. What are you going to do? Five moons, they mean. But, of course, Charon is the biggest one. One other question for you, Kate. Did you ever get your QSL card from Stephen Walsh's laboratory in NASA for the Juno mission? It's on the way. I got mine. Back to you, Jay. This is WS.
I did, about 2 weeks ago. Pretty cool, right?
Very, very good. I put it into one of those plastic frames that you put on a desk. You can see both sides of it that way. Okay, back to you, and then if anybody has any questions, I'll listen to the rest of the night. I had a good field day, by the way, Dick. Stayed there pretty late, but couldn't stay as late as we normally do. Okay, back to you, and I'll be listening out.
Paul, if you were at the Weimar field base, so was I, I probably met you. But anyway, back to the net, and thanks very much. Take over to you.
Yeah, I'm noticing that the precept 5 is off again, I'm sorry to say. Also, I noticed at times that the precept 5 has a lot of noise to it. In other words, it sounds like there's four automobiles giving you emission status on the input frequency of the 147-375 output. Eric is working on that. The equipment that's providing the RF link between east and west, the 85 machine is the west and the precept 5 machine is the east. And that equipment is being bombarded by a spread spectrum commercial equipment that's on the same tower. And it's being interfered with in both directions, east to west and west to east, with this radio link. So Eric is working on that. And I guess once he retires, I'm guessing that Lou will be part of that effort also. So that's another thing that's going to get better as time goes on. I think there's no further questions on the SpaceNet portion tonight, so we'll go over to Wes. And so those are beautiful pictures of the test equipment you've, I presume, purchased within the last year, Wes. You've got quite a laboratory of equipment that can measure the spectroscopy, or the contents. In other words, when you put a sample of some kind of substance your machinery, you're able to find out how much platinum, how much gold, how much carbon, and so on, is what I believe you're able to do. WS2N, K2LIW. Unfortunately, we haven't reset the machine. I can see that 375 is off right now. So the people who live out east only can hear that one. But that's going to be troublesome. If they have an antenna on the roof of their house, that the propagation we're getting tonight, they'd have no trouble, in my opinion, on Eastern Long Island, hearing the Western Machine 146.85 Harry up there is hearing us gangbusters, and I'm hearing Harry on the input with his force 12 element Yagis on 2 meters at the 160 foot level of his tower. He's putting a gangbuster signal down here. I think he's running something like 60 watts. Is that correct? You're running roughly 60 watts, Harry, is a guess on my part, to be 1 dBH KQRAW.
Yeah, I'm running 100 watts right now. The antenna is pointing in your direction. I'm talking over on the other repeater. You might want to give this a try, Dick. You know, conditions are so good. Go to 145.47, 145.47, with a PL of 136.5, 136.5. That's the one that our group is on, and I suspect you just might hit it tonight.
I was going to ask you, what is 145.47? That is, and I'm amazed, you guys also use 136.5 as a PL, so that's the local repeater within, let's say, 50 miles of your QTH, is that what you're saying, Harry? And it's your local group, and that group, what name is that group, Harry, go ahead. Maybe Harry was telling me to go there now. I'm in the middle of a check there, so I'm not going to do that now, but I'm going to do it later. W1EBH, KQRAW, are you still there, Harry?
Yes.
Apparently not. Okay, one more call, Wes. WS2N, KQRAW, you there, Wes?
W1PV, get your call.
Okay, we're copying you a little bit spotty. I'm going to go to listen to you on the input. W1VVH, KQRAW, what's the name of the group on 145.47? Over to you, Harry.
Okay, yeah, sorry about that. My PL tone got knocked off by accident. By the way, you're S9 on the input now. Yeah, it's the Nightly Nutnet group. And so if you go over there right now, the conditions the way they are, you might be able to check in and say hello. Some of these guys have listened to you when the band opens up from time to time in the past.
Okay, that's a good name. Nightly Nutnet group. Nightly Nutnet Group. Triple NG. No easy way to pronounce that. Good group. Okay, as soon as the technet's over, I'm going to give that a try. So in theory, I'll be there in 35 or 40 minutes or so. Harry, thank you for checking in tonight. One more call. Let's see if Wes is around. WS2N. You wanted to sign in after the SpaceNet. SpaceNet is completed. WS2N, take your rally. Go ahead, Wesley.
That's who's going to have to change his call. Too close to mine, Dick. WS2N.
Did I make the mistake? In 2XJN, you're saying that's close to W. Did I use the wrong call? Is that the problem?
46.85, just like Jerry. PL is 136.5. Bob, you may get into it tonight. It's that good.
In 2XJN. Two questions that I have. One of them would be, you have colored and reflected signal in the brochure cable that has mismatch of impedance, and those two don't see each other. Then what's happening in a hotspot? I understand that in a hotspot we have a larger current. By touching the brochure cable, we would be actually able to see that. But would be any circumstance that reflected and forward would see each other. Question.
If the coaxial cable has uniform impedance, you're launching an ordinary signal in that cable. A coaxial cable usually has HF, VHF, UHF type signals. Be a little bit careful now about the every piece of coax cable has a so-called waveguide mode. If you go to a high enough frequency, the signal will go down your coaxial cable and it ignores the center conductor. It just looks at the other conductor as a piece of waveguide. So now you can get a mixture of coaxial signal and waveguide signal. You get some funny effects. Believe it or not, even those don't mix. The signal itself, propagating from transmitter toward load, does not see the signal that's moving from load toward transmitter. Does not see it. The signal going up does not signal a signal going down, and vice versa. They pass right through each other with no effect. However, if the signal coming back down on the exact same frequency with a fixed phase compared to the signal going up, then yes, the coax cable, let me drop, the coax cable experience a certain amount of signal, a certain amount of heating throughout the whole length because of the signal going up. The coax cable receives a certain amount of signal throughout the whole length because of the signal coming down. But because the signal coming down is on the exact same frequency with a fixed phase relationship, then I've set up a standing wave. Standing wave really means that there are certain portions of the cable where the signal going up and the signal coming back down are always in phase with each other. Specific places in the cable where the signal coming up and coming back down are out of phase with each other. Therefore, you get hot spots. And yes, you could feel it with your hand, or you could look at it in a much more sensitive manner with a thermal imaging camera. And think that the signal going up and the signal coming back down have mixed together, and you think that that has made the hotspot. Drop. That has not made the hotspot. The hotspot is because of the standing wave, and the signal being co-phase in one spot and anti-phase in another spot. If you had a knob in your hand where you could be juggling the phase of the signal coming back down, the signal coming back down might be on the exact same frequency. You've got a signal generator, synthesized signal generator, sending a signal up. You've got a synthesized signal generator sending the signal down. And you've got a phase control on the second signal generator, and you juggle that phase control back and forth. You're not changing the frequency. You're not changing the strength of the signal. You're not changing the direction of propagation of either signal. You're only moving the phase of the one coming back down. Juggle that phase knob, and the hot spots will move proportionately. As you juggle the phase of the signal coming back down, you create a brand new position on the cable where the hot spots are, and a brand new position where the cold spots are. As you juggle the phase, you'll see those hot spots move back and forth as if the fingers of a comb, so to speak, and you're sliding the comb along the coax cable. One of the teeth of the comb, so to speak, is the hot spot. So the hot spot is not because the signal mixed, because the cable experienced co-phase and anti-phase signals going up and coming back down, and in the co-phase places, it's getting twice as much heating. In the anti-phase places, it's getting no heating at all. So, as I said, it's easy to jump to the conclusion the signal's mixed because of the hotspots. I say absolutely not. One of it's a little more clear, Wes, and I know that this is not an easy one to absorb the first time you hear it. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, George Chan. Dick, last time we spoke with Saunders that the signal that is coming from the transmitter is varying in the frequency, so the signal at the end of the coaxial cable will be more capacitive in character. So my understanding is that the frequency of my ear of the transmitter is the frequency of the resonance of the antenna, but we don't have the antenna, we have a short wire that can drop. When we have a inductive character, at that point there is no flipping type. So, signal that it comes back, bounce back, but we don't have the phase flip. If there is a capacitive character, then we have a phase flip of 180 degrees, say. Now, there are two questions there. If we have a phase flip, then those two signals don't see each other. But if we have not flipped, then by which means the forward and reflected doesn't see each other. So we have a sort of complicated issue here. Attention.
I think I see where you're going with this one now, Wes. I'm disappointed at the 735 is not on the air. Reset time. If I start off with a half-wave dipole at resonance, I'm feeding a resonance signal to it. All the signal goes down the transmission line once, hits the dipole, gets radiated, and there's no reflection. Every normal dipole, when I feed it a frequency higher than resonance, I will get an inductive reactance reflection. It's a lagging signal. If I feed it a lower frequency than resonance, I'll see a capacitive reactance. By the way, whether it's capacitive or inductive, you can look at it by knowing that within the dipole, the signal has to reflect back and forth multiple times before it gets radiated. Coming up. And if the signal, if the dipole is a little bit too long in length, that's a fancy way of saying I've gone to too high a frequency compared to its resonance, or I've made it physically too long. In either case, the signal is going through a longer length of wire of the dipole as far as wavelength is concerned. Therefore, it comes back late, and we call late inductive. Got to give it a name. We call it inductive. And if the dipole is too short, or you're feeding it too lower frequency, longer wavelength, therefore the same piece of wire ain't long enough. In either case, lower frequency or too short, it looks like a capacitor. And the signal comes back leading in phase because it's coming back from the end of the dipole too soon. Whether the dipole is giving you a capacitor reactance, we get a predictable amount of reflection on the transmission line, or whether the dipole is giving you an inductive reactance, which gives you a predictable amount of reflection on the transmission line. In either case, when you go above or below the right frequency for your dipole, you've created a standing wave ratio, you've created a reflecting signal, you've created a predictable amount of reflective signal, because you can predict the phase angle of the reflection and the magnitude of the reflection. You can predict exactly where the hot spots will be. Period. How hot will the hot spots be? How strong will the reflective signal be? Where will the hot spots be? That is all deterministic. Because the impedance of the dipole, by way of the, let me drop, the exact impedance of the dipole by laboratory empirical measurements by Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward in 1945, this exhaustive study, impedance of the dipole is thoroughly predictable. Once you know its diameter, once you know its length, once you know the frequency you're operating at, what exact impedance your dipole is going to give you, predictable. Therefore, if the dipole is anything but 70 ohms, so to speak, if you're using 70 ohm transmission line, then you know you're going to get some reflection. The magnitude of the reflection, the phase angle of the reflection are thoroughly predictable. Therefore, the hot spots are thoroughly predictable. Although it's a crazy sounding situation, you can keep it up in the available information. This is a deterministic situation. This is a predictable situation. There's no random variable on this one. This one is somewhat defined if you're deep enough into it, if you know what I mean, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
I'm trying to find the solution to explain phenomena of forward not change of phase. It is like when we have a sleeping phase or we have a change of phase, it is completely understandable that those signals don't change. Let's say we have no phase sleep, although we have reflection, which happened due to the inductive reaction. Then we have a signal that is going exactly the same place, physical in space, forwards and back. By all means, you would double the amplitude of the signal if you look at the quadrature of your oscilloscope. So you should have ability for the forward to align with reflected. And just here.
I've got to be careful how we use the word phase flip here, Wes. Assume now I'm just putting variable resistors at the end of a coax cable and I'm running an experiment. And if it's a 50 ohm cable and I put a 50 ohm resistor, all of the energy going down the cable gets absorbed by that resistor, none of it reflects. If the resistor I put there is any number of ohms lower than 50, all the way down towards short circuit, any number of ohms lower than 50, the reflection I get off that resistor will be 180 degrees out of phase with the signal that I deliver to the resistor. That's the magic of the way transmission lines behave. If the transmission line sees a pure resistor lower in impedance than the characteristic gate of the cable, signal reflecting off of that resistor will be exactly 180 degrees out of phase. If the resistor is greater than 50 ohms in this example, 51 ohms all the way up to infinity, I'm still going to get a predictable amount of amplitude of reflection, but the reflection at the resistor will be at 0 degrees in phase. So lower than 50 is phase reversal. Greater than 50, you get exactly the same phase if it's a pure resistor. Now, if I start adding capacitors and inductors one at a time in series with the resistor, for instance, or I could do it in parallel, now I'm getting not a pure 0 degrees, 180 degrees phase shift. I'm getting a different phase angle, which is predictable. But it's not 0 or 180. It's not a phase flip. Yes? If
repeater, time out.
If the amount of capacitor resistor, capacitor reactance, I put in series with the resistor, is a great big capacitor, very small capacitor reactance, and if the resistor happens to be lower than 50 ohms, I'll see something very close to 180. But because of the capacitor, which tends to give you, I'll not see 180, see 175, and it's predictable. If I put a series inductor, which gives me a lag, and the resistor is slightly lower than 50 ohms, instead of seeing 180, I'll see 185, increasing phase. So, there's various combinations of resistors and capacitors, along with the resistor, and I can put them in parallel or in series, slightly different calculation. But what magnitude of reflection I'm going to get, what phase angle I'm going to get, I can give you a formula that tells you exactly what you're going to get. Transmission lines have that degree of predictability, and it's not too complicated a formula, if you know what I mean. Maybe that helps a little bit, Wes. M2XJS, K2RIW.
Well, this part I completely understand. I was maybe not specifically asking about what really I want to hear the answer for. When I have no place to sleep, that means that I have reflection at the same phase as the forward signal. I just don't understand how come those two signals do not zoom themselves in the opposite direction. Anyway, here.
When it comes to transmitting a radio signal, there's a zillion different medium I can use to do that. I can use a coax cable. I can use twin leads. I can use waveguides. I can use beam waveguides, where I've really got a dish at the bottom of the tower aiming a signal up. I've got a dish at the top of the tower receiving the signal. That's called beam waveguide. And so the majority of that transmission line is pure air. Or I can send a signal from a broadcast station through the air to a house in Queens, and that air is a medium for the transmission line, for the transmission signal. And so some of our signals are coming from Manhattan. Some of those signals are coming from Yonkers. Some of those signals are coming from Brooklyn. Some of those signals are coming from New Jersey. All of those signals in the air, hitting your antenna in your house, flying through the air in your house, all of those signals do not see each other. There is absolutely no interaction.
You have two things over there. You have a Doppler, and then you have a phase shift. I understand. I'm talking about a situation at which you have a reflection with no distortion to the face.
Every real termination you put at the end of the cable that is not a perfect 50 ohm pure resistor, using 50 ohm cable, no matter what else you put there, you're going to get a reflection. The reflection is going to be some particular amplitude, some particular phase. The difference in the phase moves where the hot spots on the cable are going to be. always going to be hot spots on the cable. They may be so minor because the reflection is so small that your hand can't feel it, but you use a sensitive enough thermal imaging camera, you will always see hot spots. The hot spots, the locations, are always predictable once you know the phase of the reception of your load on that cable. Really get exactly 0 degrees of phase shift with an open circuit? No. Can you really get exactly 180 degrees of phase shift with a short circuit? No. Get approximately zero, approximately 180, it's never exactly there, for a very good reason. Think you put a short circuit. Put a great big fat piece of wire between the center conductor and the outer shield. Let me drop. And to your eye, that's the best short circuit in the world. To that radio signal, the length of that wire that makes the short circuit is a small number of nanohenries of inductance. Think you've made a short circuit. A short circuit is very hard to make. There's always a little bit of stray inductance. When you put a completely open circuit at the end of the cable, and you think you have infinite ohms, absolutely not. There's always a little bit of stray fringing capacitance between that center conductor and the shield in the vicinity of the end of the cable that's cut. There's always a little bit of stray capacitance. So in the real world, if you've got the right kind of a good calibration on your vector network analyzer, let me drop. What you think is an open circuit is a very high impedance with a little bit of stray capacitance to it. What you think is a short circuit is a little bit of stray series inductance. So you never get exactly zero. You never get 180. Nothing in this world is perfect. If I had to make a perfect short circuit and I put a complete flat plate of copper at the end, that's about the best I'm going to do. However, you make a careful enough measurement with that, you're still going to see a little bit of inductance.
Understood. Now, question. You're changing the impedance of the transmitter. So let's say you have whatever parameters you have on the shorted coaxial cable. So coaxial cable is shorter than the air. Now you're varying the impedance of the transmitter. What is happening to the signal?
Okay. What knob are you turning? What do you do to change the impedance of your transmitter? There's a zillion different answers depending on how you do that. How are you changing the impedance of your transmitter? Over to you.
What about a tank sink? The tank circuit. Or let's say you have a transformer. Whatever frequency you're using. 20 kilohertz or 20 megahertz. Now you're changing the impedance of your transmitter. But a cable doesn't change. The cable is 50 ohms. Now you have a cable that has a certain length, shorted at the end. It does give me a certain value. What happens when we change the impedance? Lower or higher than the coaxial cable? Answer is yes.
Okay, I'm going to start with a simple case and allow it to get more complicated. I got a 50 ohm coax cable of some length. I have a 50 ohm dummy load at the end of it. So the signal going down the cable is only going to go down there once, get absorbed, and nothing reflects. Now I've got this knob on the transmitter. Maybe the transmitter has a pi output tank circuit. And I'm now able to change by the tuning and loading controls on that pi tank circuit, I can change the apparent impedance of that transmitter. I can make the impedance look high, look low, look capacitive, look inductive. I've got, as long as those two knobs don't run out of range, I've got a lot of range. I can make that transmitter, if I plotted the apparent impedance of the transmitter and I put it on a Smith chart, I can fill in a whole circle of area near the center of that Smith chart. The dead center of the transmitter of the Smith chart is 50 ohms. I can make the signal generator look like 50 ohms, and I can draw a circle that's halfway between the center of the Smith chart and the outer perimeter of the Smith chart. I can draw a circle with my compass, and I fill that in with a red pencil, so to speak. And so if I design my pi network correctly, I can make the dot of my impedance of that transmitter fall anywhere in that colored area of the Smith chart. Let me drop. when I do that, when I adjust the transmitter for exactly a 50 ohm source, then I get the maximum transfer of energy between the transmitter and the coax cable. As I make the transmitter look like a 25 ohm source or a 100 ohm source, then I only get a smaller fraction of the power coming out of the transmitter going into the cable. That's the impedance matching problem. I could, if I want to, compensate for that. I could make the transmitter look like 25 ohms. I'm now only getting, let me pick a number, 70% of the power going into the cable. But now I boost the power of the transmitter by 30%. And now I could keep the power going into the cable constant as long as I use the three controls, tuning and loading, that made it 25 ohms, and power output of the transmitter. I boost it up, and now I'm still putting the same power into the transmission line. But I've got a source impedance that's now 25 ohms instead of 50 ohms. My transmitter is less efficient, but I can force the amount of power going into the transmission line to be the same. Okay. As far as the dummy load is concerned, he'll never know the difference. But there's a catch. Let me drop it. If now the load at the end of the transmission line is anything but a 50 ohm resistor, anything but, I'm going to get some reflection. Signal going down, doesn't see the signal coming back. The signal coming back comes back to the transmitter. If the transmitter was exactly 50 ohms, the signal comes back once, hits the transmitter, and gets absorbed, even though the transmitter is continuously cranking out a signal. If it's a pure 50 ohm transmitter, he does not see the reflected signal. Of course that's crazy, but that's the way it acts. If the transmitter is really 50 ohms, think he's a transmitter, and when it comes to creating the signal, he is. But for a signal flowing back, he is simultaneously a dummy load. And if the transmitter is exactly 50 ohms, he absorbs all the reflected signal, and it only reflects once. Now, when I make that transmitter anything but a 50 ohm resistor, let me drop it. Of the signal that reflects back and hits the transmitter, and the transmitter is lower than 50 ohms, like 25, then the signal does a 180 degree phase reversal and goes back forward a second time. Or if the transmitter is 100 ohms, which is greater than 50, the signal reflects off the transmitter, the signal reflecting from the load comes back to the transmitter and doesn't flip 180 degrees, it goes re-reflecting forward. So when the transmitter is not a 50 ohm source, now all the reflected signals from your short circuit at the end of the cable come back to the transmitter, get re-reflected forward again. Depending on the length of the transmission line, depending on whether the transmitter is higher or lower than 50 ohms, tells me whether or not my transmission line becomes a cavity resonator. Now the signal is bouncing back and forth like an antenna. The signal bounces back and forth 10 times before it finally gets dissipated. Because the signal is bouncing back and forth many times, depending on the length of the coax cable, if it is a resonant length and all those bounces are co-phase, now the hot spots in the cable are really going to get hot, because the total voltage on the cable just got higher. The total current on the cable just got higher, because the reflected signals are not being dissipated. They're being combined in phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter right now, and you're building up bigger and bigger magnitudes.
Got it. Thank you very much for that. Now, one more question. You have a coil and a capacitor connected together, but not connected anywhere. You have just coil and a capacitor. This thing has a resonance frequency. One of the questions is it series resonance circuit, or is it a parallel resonance circuit? Now, what you're doing is you take your coaxial cable, feed it from the transmitter. At the end of the that coaxial cable, you put whatever the antenna, could put the coil, loop coil, whatever. It does have exactly the frequency of that resonance circuit that is next to it, which is the coil and the capacitor not connected to anywhere. Now what we have is, we have a signal that is coming out from the coaxial cable. It's meeting the resonance of that coil over here. And then we have a time delay. Because this thing, when it starts to resonate, it creates a magnetic field, an electric field. Now, this thing is re-emitting the signal. Heck, what kind of the interaction do you see there?
The easiest way to run that test is to take a capacitor and inductor, put them across each other. You've now created a resonant circuit that has a predictable resonant frequency. Take your grid dip oscillator, bring it nearby, might be half a foot away, but if you carefully tune the grid dip meter, as the grid dip meter sweeps in frequency across the resonant frequency of your inductor and capacitor, the magic of wireless, the magic of resonance, is that some of the energy, the resonating coil of the grid dip meter, it's coupled to that inductor and capacitor sitting on your wooden table, and your grid dip meter, because energy got sucked out of it, the needle on the grid dip meter goes down. The total circulating energy in the resonator of the grid dip meter goes down because somebody has sucked away some of the energy. That's the magic of resonance. Does that help a little bit?
Yes, it does, but it's pretty little established. You have a coil and a capacitor as a source of the receiver, which is the receiving part. And then, how would you qualify that? Is it serious resonance circuit, or is it the parallel resonance circuit? It's not connected anywhere.
Yeah. Is it serious or resonant or parallel resonant? And the answer is yes and yes. It is both, or it is neither. If I take the inductor and the capacitor, connect them against each other, and put it in air, it looks like it's a parallel resonant circuit. If I now bring the lower end of the capacitor and the lower end of the resistor and the lower end of the inductor, and I bring them down to a flat sheet of copper, and now as I take the point of attachment of the capacitor and the point of attachment of the inductor, the bottom end, and I start sliding them apart on that sheet of copper, but I keep resoldering as I slide them apart. Eventually, I've got the capacitor connected to the left-hand side of the copper sheet, the inductor connected to the right-hand side of the copper sheet, and they look like they're in series. And as I start bringing them back closer together, they look like they're in parallel. And if you measure the resonant frequency all the way, you'll get almost the exact same resonant frequency with one slight catch, and that is, as the inductor lies parallel to the sheet of copper, the sheet of copper will be cutting some of the magnetic lines coming out of the inductor, therefore the apparent inductance will be lower. But except for that effect, I could slowly slide those bottom leaves of the two things on that copper sheet close together, and they look like parallel, far apart, and they look like series. It's the exact same circuit. So is it series or is it parallel? The answer is yes. There's no clear answer to that one. But the fact that it's resonant means that it will suck up some of that energy, therefore the grid dip meter will dip. And for the S2N, K2XJN, K2LAW,
resonated by this circuit, and it comes back as an impact.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, the energy that gets sucked out of the grid dip meter goes into your LC network, your coil, your resonator. You want to know where that energy goes? Is that your question?
Well, you have a fairly close. This resonance circuit that I described, which is the coil and the capacitor, but not connected anywhere, to the coil or the loop antenna that is connected to the coaxial cable that has the same exact frequency, then we have a two-way situation. One of the resonances, which both of them are different, the parallel is different, and the serious is different. One of the resonances would then create a electromagnetic field in that coil capacitor, and that this thing starts to re-resonate back. So we have a close distance to the transmitting coil of the loop antenna, And then we have a mismatch of the impedance just a little. We should see the impact of that re-radiated power from that coil capacitor on that antenna. And then increase of the reflected power. And to hear.
Every circuit that resonates alongside any other circuit has a certain coupling coefficient. Unless one of those circuits is thoroughly shielded, there is always a definable coupling coefficient. Once you know the coupling coefficient, which you can measure or you can calculate, once you know the geometry, you now know the amount of interaction and how close the frequencies have to be to identical before you get coupling. As the coupling coefficient gets bigger and bigger, you can be further and further away from resonance and still get a reaction. But you always get the maximum reaction when the signal generator is on the resonant frequency of that separate LC network, the separate tuned network. So everything has a coupling coefficient, which can be measured, and that determines how close it's got to be. As the Q of your inductor and capacitor gets higher and higher, your good depth meter can be further and further away, and you'll still get a reaction.
Okay, because we have a little time left, just as the last question for you. You have the coil capacitor, it resonates at frequency 3.5 megahertz, or let's say 2 meters, doesn't matter what the frequency is. Now, how would you describe the difference between power and serious resonance that is happening in that circuit?
If I decide to put the circuit directly at the end of a coax cable, and I decide to put the circuit between the center conductor and the shield of the coax cable, that example, I can put the capacitor and inductor in parallel or in series when going from center conductor to shield. I have the choice the way I physically set them up. And the coax cable will behave very differently depending on whether I put them in series or in parallel across the end of the cable. Is that a little clearer? KQLIW?
Yes. Well, I'm trying to...
N2XJN, are you able to hear me? KQLIW? Okay. Every resonator, depending on how big it is physically and how high it is in Q, determines how big is the area around it in which you can easily create coupling between circuit A and circuit B, so to speak. So every circuit that resonates, you could say it has a near-field range, depending on its Q and its physical size. It is possible to set up an inductor and a capacitor that is so physically large and so high in Q that I can hold my grid dip meter 5 feet away and get a reaction. That is possible. So how far away does it couple? The variables involved are the geometry of the setup and the Q of the resonator that determines how far away I get a significant amount of coupling. Maybe that helps a little. KQLIW. Yeah, I think I've heard what you said, but I'm not quite sure what the question is. Over to you. I've heard what you said. I think you're asking me, do I agree? And I think the answer is yes, I agree with what I think I have heard. Go ahead. Depending on the Q of the resonator, depending on its physical size, a given distance between signal generator and that coil can have a tight coupling or a very loose coupling as you change those variables, physical size and Q. As the physical size gets larger, there's a bigger magnetic field around it. As the Q gets higher, there's a bigger magnetic field around it. So if you give me a big enough coil, physical size, and a high enough Q, I can be a long distance away with my simple transmitter, and I can be coupled to it. Maybe that helps. Let me backtrack a little bit to make something a little bit clearer. It's at the end of the coax cable.
I put, on the center conductor of the coax cable, I put one lead of the capacitor and one lead of the inductor. And the second lead of the capacitor and the second lead of the inductor, I put it on the shield of the coax cable. I now have the inductor and capacitor in parallel at the end of the cable. And now I sweep the frequency out of the signal generator. As I hit resonance, that parallel inductor and capacitor at resonance become a perfect open circuit. The cable will think it's terminated with a resistor of near infinity. If I do the opposite, if I now take one lead of the capacitor, put it on the center conductor of the coax cable, other lead of the capacitor I connect to one lead of the inductor, and the last lead of the inductor I connect to the shield of the coax cable, I now got the two of them in series, and I sweep the frequency again. Now when I hit resonance, it will look like a perfect short circuit. So series resonance circuit at the end of a cable looks like a short circuit. A parallel resonance circuit at the end of a cable looks like an open circuit. You have the choice of doing one or the other, and there's ways you can combine those. But now you see, in that example, there's a lot of difference between series resonance and parallel resonance. Maybe that helps. KQLIW. Okay, this is not exactly on your question, but maybe it's going to help. Let's assume now that I want to build a pretty good antenna for 1 megahertz. Oh, let me make it half a megahertz. Half a megahertz, the wavelength is 600 meters. 600 meters is 185 feet or something like that. Oh, wait a minute, 1,850 feet? Yeah. It's a big number. No reasonable antenna can fit into my backyard and work at half a megahertz, 500 kc. But I've got a choice. Because of the magic of resonance, as I said many times, building an antenna, resonate first, then it will radiate. I can make a flat coil, a toroidal coil. I can make various kinds of coils, which have once you tell me the diameter of the coil and the number of turns and the spacing of the turns, I can go to a formula and tell you exactly how many microhenries or millihenries of inductance I've got. Good job. Now, once I know the number of millihenries, I can choose the right size capacitor that will cause it to resonate at 500 kilohertz, half a megacycle, in my case. As long as that coil is not shielded, as long as that coil is made out of low enough resistance material, so it's not wasting power with resistance, that coil might be only a couple of feet in diameter. I'm trying to make an antenna that it really wants to be 1,000 feet long. And I've made this coil of wire that's only a couple of feet in diameter, but I have forced it to resonate. And now if I couple to it correctly, tap the right number of turns on that coil, connect it to the center conductor of the coax cable, and the grounded end of the coil, connect the shield of the coax cable, if I do the right coupling coefficient between the transmitter and that coil, running at half a megacycle, it can be a reasonably good transmitting antenna. It certainly can be a very good receiving antenna. A receiver is very forgiving. So I can take that coil of wire that I have forced it to resonate, and if the receiver has enough sensitivity, I'm going to pick up that 500 kc signal. The loopstick antenna in your coax, in your transistorized radio, does that. I could take that example if I wanted to and make it operate not at 500 kc, I could make it operate at 50 kc. I'm now at ultrasonic audio, but I can make a radio transmitter out of it as long as I've got a low enough resistance coil and I force it to resonate and I couple to it correctly. The magic of resonance, but a better way of looking at it is, if you're building an antenna and you want to transmit, resonate first, then it will radiate. It doesn't have to be huge in size according to wavelength if you're smart enough. Maybe that helps a little. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW. There may not be a simple answer to that one. However,
you can buy oscilloscope probes that have an extremely high impedance. You can buy a field effect transistor type oscilloscope probe if you want to. And if you connect the probe to the right, across one of the turns of the coil, across the capacitor, you choose the right place to put the oscilloscope probe. And make non-disturbing measurements. You can find out how much voltage, how much current is flowing into the coil, into the capacitor, into your resonator. You can find out how much response it's having, and it can be a non-contaminating test if you set up the probe correctly. So there's various ways. You can probe the field, you can probe the voltage, you can probe the current. You can find out what is the reaction of this passive circuit that's alongside of your active circuit. Your active circuit is the transmitter into the coax cable. And you want to know, is it coupling to the coil? The transmitter is not going to tell you that. But your oscilloscope with a high impedance probe connected correctly to that resonator will tell you immediately how much response, how strong a response, what phase angle of response, what phase angle and amplitude as a function of frequency of the signal generator. You can sweep the system and find out where the response is. You can change the spacing between the two and study how much the response goes up or down as a function of spacing. You have the instrumentation that if you're smart enough and you connect it, you can make a non-contaminating test of almost anything you want to know. Maybe that helps. Over to US, K2RIW.
Code number 9126. Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club computer system. Think active.
You said something that I disagree with, Wes. If I put a series inductor and capacitor across the end of the cable, at resonance, it's a short circuit. If I put an inductor and capacitor in parallel across the end of a cable, at resonance, it's an open circuit. At all other frequencies, it's a almost short circuit. Series capacitor inductor at resonance is a short circuit. At almost all other frequencies, it's almost an open circuit. So you were starting to say that a parallel resonance circuit passes all frequencies. I don't agree. Depending on how you're using, how you're coupling to it, both circuits, series or parallel, can be doing the filtering. But now, are you trying to create a notch in the filter passband? Use series resonance. Are you trying to create a passband frequency? Use parallel resonance. So in both cases, they are doing what they're supposed to do at resonance. They do something very different off resonance in both cases. I don't agree that a parallel LC passes all frequencies. If you're using it correctly, it passes one frequency. A series resonance circuit, you could say it rejects all frequencies. No, it rejects one frequency. So do you want to reject or do you want to pass? You're going to use it series or parallel. And in either case, you get the maximum response, whichever response you designed into it, at resonance. OBUS, K2RIW. Okay, so I think the conclusion is that if you're smart enough, there are places where you get the best performance out of a series circuit. There are other places where you get the best performance, that might be what you're looking for, out of a parallel circuit. And really good filters do both. There's a certain kind of filter, a ladder network, which has series networks passing the desired frequency, parallel networks passing the desired frequency, and in other places, it's got series networks rejecting some other frequency, and so on. So there are ways of building a filter, just using series networks, parallel networks, and all set up just right so that you can tailor the pass band and tailor the stop band the way you want it. There are places where each does the job correctly if you're smart enough. N2XJN, K2RIW. That's a tough one. All I can say is it's going to require more study. Does every circuit that responds to a signal by resonance re-radiate the signal? Yes. You could say to some degree that's exactly how an RFID tag works, because in a well
dipole antenna. Of all the energy that hits the dipole antenna and gets absorbed by it, exactly half of that energy gets re-radiated into space, and half of the energy goes down the transmission line into the receiver. No matter what you do with the dipole, from one point of view, as a receiving element, it is 50% efficient. Therefore, you can calculate what is its effective capture area. You know how much signal it is absorbing from the environment. And of all the signal it absorbs from the environment, exactly half of it gets re-radiated into the environment as if you connected a transmitter to its transmission line, even though it's really a receiver connected to its transmission line. A dipole has 50% efficiency. It radiates exactly half of everything it sees. Ain't that crazy? 2XJN, K2RIW. Okay, I know an article you can read, because I know the author, and it's going to help. I'm not going to explain everything, but it's going to help. Go to Mike's website, K1MJM. Get there by going to mymarktechnet.com. mymarktechnet.com. And one of the first articles on the upper left-hand side on that page is called the Bubble article, or it's also called the Radar Cross-Section article. It's a so-called Bubble article, which is also called, I think it's called Radar Cross-Section. If you read, it's a three-part article. If you read the first portion of that, the so-called Bubble experiment, it will partially explain what I think you're asking. It's not going to give you the whole answer. It's going to give you some of the answer. It's an entirely different way of looking at what a dipole does. A dipole is a kind of resonator. It has an equivalent circuit of a series inductor capacitor, the small resistor. Yeah, the article, the website is run by K1MJM, but you don't need that to find it. You're going to find the website by just using as a URL address, mymarktechnet.com. And he, this man, K1MJM in Connecticut, has set up this website. And one of the first articles there is called the Bubble Article. It comes in three parts, but the first part, it's got about 1,000 words, 1,500 words. It's going to explain a dipole antenna as a resonator. It's going to help you somewhat. Okay, looks like you got it. It's, that Bubble article will partially explain what you're looking for, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW. Yes, I did. And I'm seeing some very elaborate test equipment. You've got quite a laboratory. As I said earlier, it looks to me like you have...
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Code number 916 on the New England reflector. Link.
It looks like you have the ability to analyze substances and find out how much of what is there. I'm going to have to leave you, Wes. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW.
Auto connecting.
Code number 9126. Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. 9126 on the New England Link active. Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Plan 126 on the New England Reflector.
All token open.
Code number 9126. Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, code number 9126 on the New England Reflector. Link.